So how can we define ethics? Does anyone wants to suggest a definition? What is ethics? Yes. What is right and what is wrong? But there is a difference between what is right and what is wrong from the point of view of the law and from the point of view of ethics. So what is this difference? Anyone? Yes. Yes. So what is a moral system then? Yes. Yes. So ethics is about values that are largely agreed by society. And who thinks that these values are fixed and who thinks that this value changes? Yes. Okay, so it's not fixed in the sense that it's not like the Ten Commandments. So it's the rules are a bit more complicated. But what I wanted to ask is that if it can change, not only if the rules are simple. Yes. Yes, so there is some variability, but is ethics completely different from different parts of the world, or can we assume there is a core that is more or less the same? Yes. Yeah. So can you cite some principles that you think are common? And of course, they don't have to be exceptionless. These principles can have exceptions. So one example is do not steal from others. What other examples can there be? Yes. Don't murder. So it's although some values are widely shared, there can be situations in which the way you apply the value and the principle is more complicated. And this is yes. Yes, but even other people can come to the same conclusion that in a situation stealing was justified, or at least that it should be punished less harshly because of some countervailing values. So let's sum up what we have discussed until now. So first of all, there are some general norms that are widely shared within a society, and some of these are common across different societies. But these norms, they have exceptions, and it requires some thinking to determine the exception to the general norm, or how to solve a conflict between different moral norms. And this is pretty much the situation that we find in the ethics of cybersecurity. If you have watched the MOOC, and has anybody watched the MOOC? Okay. One. What? Yes. So 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. So a significant minority has watched the MOOC. So what the MOOC tries to explain is some of the ways to think about morality and ethics that have been developed within philosophy, and how to apply them to the cases of cybersecurity. Why that? Because, as pointed out before, the values that we all share can be questioned, need to be questioned when they are applying to concrete phenomena. You don't derive a simple answer from the values that have been taught in scenarios that are complicated. And philosophers, they are people who in history they've tried to reflect about ethics in order to understand, in a sense, what is behind the rules that we learn from society, with the idea that if you have an idea of what is behind, you can then apply this idea to different contexts. So who can give me an example of an ethical theory? Yes. Let's give the simplest definition of utilitarianism. There are different forms of utilitarianism. Let's define the simplest one. Yes. 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 So utilitarianism, it's very simple. It's a very simple ethical theory. It says, in the simplest form, it says that the right action is the action that maximizes the good. And in the simplest form of utilitarianism, the good is defined as happiness, or as it's used today, well-being. And the simplest form of utilitarianism, well-being, is defined as pleasure, but it doesn't have to. So when it's used in economics, utilitarianism typically uses preferences, not pleasure. So basically, the good is what satisfies people's preferences. Hence, maximizing the good means maximizing what satisfies the largest amount of preferences, maybe weighted by their intensity. And the right action is the action that maximizes again, well-being, that is to say, pleasure over pain or the satisfaction of preferences. Is utilitarianism the only ethical theory? Yes. Yeah, this is an example of virtue ethics. This was Aristotle's idea of the virtue as the middle ground. Yes. Okay. Someone else? Yes. Yeah. Deontological ethics. So deontological ethics says that the right action is about following a certain rule. Is this different from utilitarianism? Why? Yes, so we can go back to your earlier example, and we can say that from the point of view of act utilitarianism, stealing from a rich person to feed a starving child maximizes the good. That action creates more good than it creates pain, assuming, as it seems plausible, that meeting the basic needs of a starving child creates more happiness than, you know, some minor loss of material wealth for a very rich person. And deontological ethics says, no, that's not how you apply the rules. There is a middle ground between the two, which is called rule utilitarianism, which basically says, no, you have to look at the rules, and then you have to follow those rules that maximize the happiness. So a rule utilitarian will say, you should stick to the rule, do not steal, even when by not stealing you're not maximizing well-being, because as you kind of pointed out, if everyone decides where to break the rules, on aggregate this will create less well-being. So this rule utilitarianism is a kind of middle ground and takes a long-term perspective, and so has some features of deontology and some features of utilitarianism. However, it's still debated whether it's coherent at all. What else? What other way is there to think about? I want to say something more about virtue ethics. The big difference between virtue ethics and deontology and consequentialism is that in virtue ethics, you typically are not really interested to provide a single rule to assess all outcomes, like utilitarianism. You're also not interested in providing a list of rules to follow. And you are not even focused on ethics as we defined at the beginning, which is what is the definition we gave, that ethics is about what is morally right and what is morally wrong. That's not how virtue ethicists see morality. They start from a different premise, which is ethics is about how you should live as a person. So they start with questions like, what is the good life, or what is the life of virtue? What kind of person do you want to be? And typically for virtue ethics, the kind of person you want to be is a person that acts right. But they're more focused on what kind of dispositions, so they're more interested, like deontology, they're more interested in the intention than in the consequences. and in the psychological makeup of the people. So these are, yes, the three main traditions in Western ethics. There is one tradition which is a bit harder to explain, and it's contractualism. So contractualism is, in a sense, a theory that provides the background for some versions of deontology. In fact, one example of contractualism can be related to Kant's idea of the categorical imperative. So Kant said that you should act in such a way that your action can work as the law for everyone. And contractualists say something similar. They say you should act in such a way that your principle could be adopted by other people. So you have to imagine yourself deciding on rules with people and arguing with them, this is the good rule for us. And in fact, even here, it's not so clear if this and utilitarianism really have to be different. A very famous philosopher who died recently called Derrida Parfit wrote a book towards the end of his career, of his life, where he claimed that, in fact, there is convergence between these two approaches, because he was claiming if you want to argue with people what is the right rule to adopt, at the end, the right rule is the rule that creates the most happiness. But not everybody agrees. So what are the problems with the rule to create the most happiness? What can be the problem? Yeah. Yes, so I'm really happy you brought up this case. This is a typical case that's used when discussing utilitarianism, but you didn't answer the question, so I'll try to answer it for you, or maybe I'll try to reformulate the question. So as your colleagues say, take a case in which a healthy patient arrives in the hospital room for some minor thing. And the utilitarian doctor, who is also a very good hacker, he could hack the medical records, could make it appear that this guy, who actually had a very minor thing, required a surgery, and then can make it appear that, you know, some accident happened during the surgery that he is not to be blamed for, and so he can distribute these organs to 10 other patients whose life will be saved, and who also have very good expectations of survival. So this maximizes the good, but we have the intuition this is not right. Now let's consider this from the point of view of contractualism. Imagine a situation in which all the patients have to agree on the rule that the doctor should follow. What could be the objection from one? Yes. Yes. So the idea here is one should try to think, would you bet on not having any protection against being killed and sacrificed when you go to a hospital in order to have greater chance to receive organs. How does that look from the individual perspective? So the contractualist is not asking, does this maximize the good, but how would you do that if you could be either person? Yes. Yeah, one could say that actually this reduces well-being in the long term from the utilitarian point of view. If you say, like, utilitarianism will say, then people are actually afraid to go to the hospital and they get even more sick. So it's not a good rule. Now the contractualist will say, when you are a person entering a hospital, imagine that the rule was written on the hospital. This is also typically of contractualism, this idea that the rules have to be public. You cannot work with secret rules. Then I give you a word. Let me just finish this concept. So imagine that in the hospital, the rule is written up there. When you enter here, you may be dismembered so that your organs are given to the sick people, if this saves more lives. Would anyone enter that hospital? No. So it doesn't seem to be the kind of rule that reasonable people will choose to run a hospital. Maybe it could work if it were a secret rule. That is why Sidgwick, which is one of the greatest utilitarian philosophers, in fact advocated for utilitarianism to be a kind of secret morality. He said, average people still stick to traditional morality. Few philosophers working together with governments should think about how to change ethics, how to change the norms. So he realized that when you make utilitarianism public, it doesn't work. It doesn't work in the case of the hospital because nobody will enter the hospital if the rule was made public. It doesn't work as a general rule for life because we are biased and we don't have all the information that's needed. And this is why, although utilitarianism seems very appealing, many philosophers oppose it. In fact, another problem is how do you measure this well-being? Utilitarianism requires that you aggregate together all the forms of well-being and ill-being. How do we do that? We are dealing with goods that are very different, from freedom to pleasure, achieving important things in life. So the ontologist, for instance, say, since you cannot sum these things, you need different rules. So one very important example of a philosopher who is a anti-utilitarian is John Rawls, who in fact has this contractualist idea where publicity is very important, and this idea that people should agree on the different rules. The idea of agreement also comes in different versions, just like utilitarianism. The most extreme one is Hobbes, that basically says you can make people agree on everything that provides a stable power, because any form of stable power that protects people's life is better than being killed in the war of all against all. Then you have Locke that says you can agree on every system of rule that protects individual life and liberty and property. So he adds liberty and property. So if a state wants to make up rules that violate liberty and property, it's never legitimate, even if people agree because of fear. And then there are the most contemporary forms like Rawls, John Rawls, that say, no, actually, not all contracts between people are fair, and people will rationally agree. He says we shouldn't look at what is rational for people in the world, but we should abstract away and imagine that you don't know who you are. And this was the example of the hospital. Because the example of the hospital, if we say, it depends who you are, right? If you are the person waiting for the organs, you say, yes, I want the rule that you can kill the healthy patient to donate. If you are the patient who is healthy, you reach the opposite conclusion. So John Rawls says, no, you have to assume you don't know who you are and then decide. And he assumes that in certain situations you can reach a conclusion. This is probably plausible in the case of the hospital. At least if you frame the question in a certain way, you can say everybody would agree that the rule of killing the healthy patient will not work if it was a public rule, because nobody will enter, nobody healthy will, or with minor disease will then enter hospitals any longer. Okay, so there was one question over there. I have problems hearing you, so maybe it's better if you get the mic and speak at the mic. Try. But it's not working. Yeah. What you mean harvesting? Okay, so let's analyze this question from the point of view of different ethical theories. Can I write on the? Yes. So the question is, so we know that some organs are not vital organs, like kidneys. You can survive with one, right? So should kidneys be taken away from healthy prisoners to give it to people who actually need a kidney to survive? Or let's say if the alternative for these other people is a dialysis machine, they have to, you know, spend most of their time attached to a machine that purifies their blood, does what a kidney will do, and this costs a lot of well-being for the people attached to the machine, and also it costs a lot for the state to pay these machines. It could use that money to improve public school, build better AI, whatever. So the question is, should kidneys be taken from prisoners against their will for the purpose, you know? And we have. So, utilitarianism says, yes, if and only if you maximize utility. And maybe in this case, with acute utilitarianism, the answer is yes. Then, the ontology. What does the ontology say? Why? Why is wrong? Anyone? So she? Yeah. Why is it wrong?
Because it goes on principle.
Sorry.
It's not about the result of the action, that being that more people now have.
1 second, sorry. They add me to a call. Well, let me take Skype out. Okay, so.
Yeah. It's about the principle and not about the end result. So if the principle is you shouldn't steal and you should, then taking people's organs, regardless of the end result, would be wrong.
Yeah, in this case, the principle, so typically the ontology goes together with rights theory. Why is there a connection? Because you have a right of a person, let's call this person X, implies a duty of Y towards X. That's for, it's called perfect duties. These are the really important duties. So what is the right here that X has? It's called personal integrity. So a right to personal integrity means nobody is allowed to take your organs without your consent, at least as you are alive. Whether organs should be taken by people who are deceased, it's far less clear, because the scope of this right is debated for deceased person. So if when you are alive, you should have the right to decide what happens to your organ once you're no longer alive, that's much more debatable. And you see here a difference when we talk about the relativity of ethics. I'm sure there's a lot of relativity about the rights about your organ when you're dead. As much less relativity about the right of personal integrity when you're alive. So the idea, and you can see very well the conflict here, because the right says you can do that to people even when it increases utility. And there's a very famous philosopher called Ronald Dworkin, American one, who wrote a couple of very good articles on rights and actually says that's actually precisely what the function of right is. It's to block this. So it's because democracy makes us do this, because everybody has got a vote, so it has this tendency to utilitarianism, and that's why we need rights. Because sometimes we don't want this. Okay. And then contractualism. So who could make the reasoning for contractualism here? Yes, with Mike.
Okay, from what I have understood, I think it would be no, because like you, if it depends, but if you could like see yourself, if you were for example in China, where they have a tendency to, or you don't have to do that much wrong to get in prison, so. If like I was a Chinese citizen and I knew like of the state and they were like of how sometimes random they could take prisoners, then I think it would be reasonable to say no, because in case you were a prisoner, you don't want people to steal you, steal your organs from you, even though most likely you wouldn't be. But from what I understood.
Yeah. So in fact, the way contractionism works, it looks at different positions at stake and say there is the prisoner, and there are the non-prisoner in this case, right? And we could say that everyone here gains a little bit. You know, we are saving on these dialysis machines and can use that money some other way. Or maybe there is a group that is gaining a bit more because they are the people who are much better off with a kidney than with a dialysis machine. And then there is the position of the prisoner. And let's assume that being a prisoner in China does not mean that you deserve to have a much lower quality of life. So let's set that apart. We can say that for the prisoner who ends up living without a kidney, there's a lot of loss in well-being, not only because of living without a kidney, which means that if the other kidney fails, that person may be dead, but also that you feel much more insecure if people can take organs from your body without your consent. How can you feel as a person? You feel you have no more status. You don't matter to society except as a resource to be used. And contractualism, so you said something important. You said, well, I maybe have to think about the probabilities. So in fact, there is a formal proof that if you think in terms of probabilities and you have a complete uncertainty, then it produces average utilitarianism, because you will basically look at what the expected benefit is, and when the expected benefit increases for the average, it also increases it for you, and so it will correspond. But in different cases like this one, so there are different ways of applying it, and one of these says, no, you don't look at the average, you should always imagine that you are in the worst of position. This is like including some sort of risk aversion. So the idea is that, first of all, when you do the contract, you want to ensure that your most basic goods are secure, and then the other gains. And then contractualism takes this situation here more seriously, because the minuses here are greater than the plus here. So the difference with utilitarianism is that in utilitarianism you are aggregating stuff, here you are not aggregating. So let's say you have a lot of these positions. Okay, maybe this is a bit too extreme, because then the intuition collapses. So the difference is that here, if you have a very small thing, for utilitarianism, it will override this. With contractualism, you just select, just look at the position, ignoring the multiplier here. So to see why this differ, suppose that you have to decide if some guy should get electric shock for 45 minutes, because if you unplug him from these electric shocks, people cannot watch the final of the World Cup. Here you have a very small plus multiplied by millions of people, and here you have big minus of the guy getting electric shocks. And with utilitarianism, you will justify it, not so with contractualism. So you only look at the individual positions, ignoring how many there are. Okay, so now we have a 15-minute break, and in the next, we did a crash course now in the ethics, which supplemented the video, and or replaced the video for those who didn't see it. And in the next part of the class, you'll go through a case study and try to apply the ethical reasoning to it. Okay, so see you in 15 minutes.
So for all of you who are online, the students from DICSEC who are online, the case studies are given under week 42, Arbeitskrav. You can find them under week 42, Arbeitskrav, case studies for now. Yes.
Argue for utilitarianism means to say
that just like you sacrifice some, you accept some pain now to create more happiness overall, the same way society should sacrifice some pain, some members with disabilities overall. But famously, the reply to that from deontologists and contractualists is to say, no, you are forgetting the, what was the form I used? Distinctiveness. So the fact that people are, I mean, people are not mixed, like one person is a sum of his stages over time. And so, and this is exactly the idea that's very right here, that you shouldn't aggregate because these are different individuals, and you should always consider one individual times one.
Yeah.
That's precisely intuition. And it's also interesting that Derek Parfit, this philosopher who is for libertarianism, one way he argued against is by saying that actually people are also not very united, because we can be very different when we are 10 years old and when we are 30 years old, and so at the end he says there is already no person that exists.
Yeah, and it's like, and it's an entire thing with me, like, yeah, when you talk about one individual, like, a person's relation to another person.
Yeah,
because, like, when you have an authority over another person to decide what you're going to do, like, it's up to your own if you want to study or not. But if it's another person to say, okay, you can study because somebody else has to study, and because we have to have the most people studying, and then you can study. Yeah, would be.
In fact, all people in these two camps, they think very strongly in terms of the person with someone who has not only happiness and pain, but also a will and a unit. While you do it,
what do you mean by will?
A will, that you make decisions, and you make decisions, first of all, for yourself, and all these things. So it's also the will that keeps the stages of a person connected. While the people there, they give much less importance, and basically look at society as atoms of well-being that something's up there, you just have to maximize these atoms.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking so much in terms of the first thing.
Yeah. Yeah, because then you have to with utilitarianism, how did you deal like with a problem of like temporarily happiness and long-term happiness?
Long-term happiness always wins, and this is another strange consequence that utilitarians would say it's just rational. But from utilitarian's point of view, we should always save for the sake of our of the generations after us. So we should basically always sacrifice our well-being more, because why? Because when you invest, let's say, 10 euros today become 100 euros in 100 euros. Or better say, if 10 euros is used not for consumption, chips, but all together and buy, make technological innovation, the same amount of resources will produce much more indeed. But the perverse consequence of that is that basically you always have a reason to save more to increase the future, and every generation has to think the same for the future, and then this goes on, it's never clear when the generation arrives can finally enjoy.
Get the benefits, and we would probably also have a problem with,
yes. Could you tell them now to download on the laptop?
Yes.
And with you,
I told them that they can find it. I told them before when you finished it, so I can remind them again.
And then to do this study too.
Okay.
So we don't have time to.
Okay.
They can have a look at my book,
So
yes, and to download
okay.
this one.
So we are ready to start the second part of this lecture. As you can see on the screen, this is the second case study from the material that you already find in week 42 under Arbeitskraft. So please access this material and we'll start right away discussing on that. I think there's no problems in accessing it, so.
Yes. Yeah. So what you will find is this description here, the question. And then you find a guide for analyzing this, which starts with building scenarios. Sorry, it starts with describing the moral question, the problem. Actually, I can show you here. So first you have to describe what you think is the moral question. Then to gather the relevant facts. Then choose a theory and apply to argue for a decision. And do this like in pairs. So each one, so starting from this side, work with the colleague on your left. Like this. So you and you, you and you, you and you. Oh, you remain alone. So with them. Let's do three. The three of you together. You and you, you and you. Could you go near to your colleague and work together? You and you. You two. With him. You two. You two there. Then two, 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 and two. It's very easy in that line. Here we can do two, two, two. No, three together there. Two, two, and two. You two in the penultimate. You and you together. Two, two, and two. Two, 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 and two. So you have to work. No, no, no. On the left together. Yeah, one and two. Then two, two, and two. Ah, sorry, I didn't see you. Okay, sorry. Okay, so two, two, two. No, two, two, three, and two.
Master of disguise.
Yes, master of disguise. He will become the hacker in this class.
I'm afraid.
Okay. So have you found the answer to the question? So first of all, let's start with the answer. So who, so please just raise one hand per group. Who thinks that blocking payment sites is ethically justified? So who thinks that it's not ethically justified? So it seems there is, who isn't undecided? Okay.
Wait.
So, theory of your choice. Let's see. So, who has chosen utilitarianism to analyze the case? Oh, that's surprising. It's probably the easiest. So maybe you can send the mic and see what theory they've tried to apply to the case. If yes, so
shall I start with you?
Please, can you get the microphone and explain so that then, okay, how you approach the question?
It's okay.
Yeah. Okay. So.
We didn't really get that far to applying any theory. So, yeah.
You were gathering the facts.
Yeah, we were gathering facts and like discussing what like pros and cons and different.
Okay, facts. So what is opposing harms and benefits? What kind of theory is that?
Utilitarianism, or?
Yeah, it's probably utilitarianism.
Yeah, probably.
Okay. So let's do like that. I'll give you other 10 minutes now from the facts. Try to relate the facts with the principle and then move on to articulate, that is to say, to produce an answer which is, it relates facts, principles, and shows why you make certain decision. Okay. So this is now step two. Okay. So now you had more time to reflect. Let's go back to our questions. And let's assume you have to decide. Because, so the assumption is if you don't block the ransom, the server, you are also deciding, right? It's not a situation where you can afford not to decide. Not to decide means you have decided something. So I will only ask if blocking the payment sites is ethically justified and assume that those who don't raise their hands are actually for not blocking it and should offer an argument. So who is it, who is for blocking the server? Okay. So it looks like blocking the server, so it's a minority. So I would like to hear, did you raise your hand for blocking servers? Okay, let's hear one version of the argument for blocking the server. Wait.
If you're looking at overall happiness, as we do in utilitarianism, then we would block the server because it will provide more safety for a lot more people than who will be affected by the attacks. Since if we stop it early and by blocking the monetary gain, it will be less prevalent and people will be less inclined to use the attacks. And so the general safety of the people will be higher and the happiness will be higher as well.
Good. Very good formulation of the argument for blocking the server from the utilitarian point of view. So how many people have used utilitarianism? Raise your hand if you use utilitarianism. Now keep your hand up. So how many of you who have used utilitarianism have reached the conclusion to block the server? So keep it, okay. Oh, sorry. Hands goes down if you are utilitarian and don't want to block the server. Okay, I think I saw a few hands dropping. Let's see if I can isolate them. Maybe they don't want to be isolated because they don't want to speak. So, who is utilitarian and doesn't want to block the server? Okay, we have one. I think you. You there? You're not utilitarian? You are utilitarian. And you want to block the server. Okay. So we have one case of a utilitarian argument against blocking the server. Would you like to speak? Thanks.
I would like to reflect that is if you block one site, there are many more they are going to use. Like they are going to the activities is going to go further if you just block one way. So instead, using that resources for blocking that server, use the same resources to do something else, like finding the hacker or something another. So many of the people will be happy if they capture the hacker for using those resources, like blocking them.
Yes, this is a very good example of utilitarian reasoning, because for utilitarians, not only you have to do something that produces more good consequence than bad consequence, that's not enough. You actually have to maximize the amount of good consequence produced. So, if we assume that, of course, and you see how much it relies on the factual basis, and utilitarianism heavily relies on the information and expected utility. When you don't have the information, you should kind of figure out the probabilities. So assuming the assumption is correct that it is futile to block a server because another one can be opened very easily, that indicates that those resources are wasted and so could be better used and produce more utility in another way. And that's exactly the way utilitarians should reason about these things. So if the facts are right, that's probably the utilitarian argument for not blocking the server. Who has tried to apply a different theory? Oh, okay, the courageous here. Let's listen. Let's start from you.
Yeah, we tried to apply deontology with the fact that the censorship that blocking sites would cause is a violation of human rights of free speech and expression. And while the duty of the government is to try to stop, it wouldn't really do anything. With they will always find a way to get money. Like patching holes isn't really enough. So we think that it's not ethical, or it wouldn't be enough to just block sites. Yeah.
Could you? So this was mentioned by my colleagues who wrote this case study. I didn't write this. So there is a long version with all the, but I still don't quite get it. Can you explain a bit better to us what is this issue with the censorship?
The shutting down any like site is you don't know like specifically like what a type of site would be used for, like even though, and also adding to that, some companies have even their backups encrypted, so they don't really have any choice but to pay, and doing that will cause them a lot of harm. I don't really have an answer for the censorship part. I just feel like that's what's the right thing.
Okay, so basically the censorship issue is that the same site that is used to collect the ransom may also be used by, I don't know, activists to fund a worthy cause. Okay, so that will be the deontological argument. That's correct. That's the basically there's a duty to respect the freedom of the web. That will be, but I'm not so convinced it's plausible in that form. And then there is, okay, I want to hear a bit more about, yes.
Regarding the censorship,
yeah.
I think the argument is that if you give the power of government to censor sites, that would be a bad thing. Not that I agree with it or anything.
Okay,
but,
so it's an overreach. There is and it's a slippery slope argument.
Yeah.
But pay attention that slippery slope arguments often are wrong. So usually, that is a red flag. The slippery slope argument should be examined very carefully, because sometimes they are used as tricks, as rhetorical tricks. Yes.
I think it's fair that a slippery slope. You could argue that it is a slippery slope. I think the important thing is to establish a clear framework of when it is okay to block, because if you essentially enable that, when you decide that, oh, this is a case where we should block. If you let that be too loose, it could be abused. And therefore, I think that it's fine to block as long as you have a very clear and rigid framework for when it is allowed.
Okay.
Otherwise, slippery slope might happen.
So the refined slippery slope arguments connected with the deontological argument of freedom says that if the decision to block is left to the people's insert without a legal or at least an administrative framework that has clear rule, this creates an opportunity for abuse for governments through the people they nominate inserts to bring down websites they don't want to be on the web. Maybe with excuses and so on, because what these cert people know, it's difficult, it's not very public, it's obscure, So the conclusion will be yes if with clear rules, no otherwise. And he wants to go back to that.
I remembered a term I heard from Edward Snowden, which is turnkey tyranny. The fact that the government now might use it correctly, but you don't know who's going to be in the government in the next couple of years.
Yes. And here again you see a difference between more utilitarian inclined people and more deontological inclined. The more deontological inclined, people just want maybe to have an absolute rule, like the extreme deontologists would say, no, the state should never do that, we should never risk. Well, the utilitarian will say, well, depends, let's try to wait, let's see case by case, which of course opens up more risk for abuse of the state, this utilitarianism. Yeah. So there were other arguments. I think you also raised your hand.
Okay.
You also mentioned another argument about the damage done to the people who cannot recover their file. And of course there is one way to frame it in the utilitarian way, and then probably it's a reason against, but it's overridden because you look at the sum and this damage, I mean, assuming which we are no longer sure, but if it's the case that you can have this team that blocks all the ransom, they developed super fast techniques, maybe with machine learning they can find and block. Of course there will be false positives which will create problems of censorship. In this case, not intentional, but because of the false positives. But let's assume we have this team, so it blocks. Whenever you see a certain kind of signal, it blocks. And let's assume so this is feasible and it's efficient. So in the utilitarian way, the problem of people who have to repay, who lose their data, is not so important because there is a general gain. But there is a way to frame this problem in the contractualist line of thinking. Yes.
With the contractual, there's sort of three sides. There's the government, there's the people who are, or four sides. There's the general public, there's the people who got scammed, the scammers, and the government. And the people who are scamming, you know, if this is blocked, then they're going to lose out quite a bit. If the people who are scammed, for them, it's sort of a lose-lose. Either they have to give up a lot of resources to regain a resource, or they have to not give up those the money, but lose out on their files. And then there's the government who has to, whose job it is to ensure that people, if a crime is committed, that people are, to prevent crimes from being committed. And the general public who, if this continues, will be exposed to more of this. It's sort of like you don't negotiate with terrorists, but instead of people being kidnapped, it's files. And files have, you could argue, less of a value than human lives. So if you don't are negotiate with terrorists about human lives, if you want to find some other way to get them back, then the same should be said about files.
Okay, so let's try to parse this out in a clearer way. But before I go to the contractualist way, basically just complementing and trying to make in a more systematic way what you just said, I just want to ask you to say what kind of theory it is, the one that says we don't bargain with terrorists. So we block all servers because terrorists should not get. Okay, so. Yes, it can be rural utilitarianism, but you spoke a lot. Someone else from there. So, what kind of argument is the one that says we don't pay ransoms? To hackers in this case, not so. The parallel will be like we don't pay ransom to terrorists, It can be really utilitarian, but sometimes, you know, it's maybe it's better to just pay. So what other argument can it be? What kind of argument it is? We don't pay ransom. Somebody up there has an answer? Okay, I hope she didn't get offended.
No, it's okay. I think
she had to go. Okay. Okay. So that is a deontological argument. Okay. Do I have 15 more minutes to conclusion?
It's okay. Yeah.
It's okay.
As long as the others are not coming in.
Okay. So when the contractualist argument goes something like that, as your colleagues say, we separate the different parties. So there are the people, the hackers, let's say, black hat hackers. There are governments, let's say, the owners of a hospital, for instance. There are the people hacked. And there are the people who have not yet been hacked. And we consider each of these individually to see who has the great claims, who has the strongest reason. So the hackers, they say, no, don't block us. But we assume the claims of these people have no weight because basically they're doing something illegal. They're just stealing from people, just creating damage. They have no rights. So these people we just ignore. Then there is the government. Let's say these people, it's the hospital. They are paying ransom. They want to reduce this risk. They don't want to deal with this problem, so they have this claim. And because the government is paid by everyone, this is basically, it's part of this group here has a claim to avoid having to pay these ransoms when it's a public entity, for instance. And this goes in favor of blocking. So now let's consider the hack. I think that a lot matters for contractualists from case to case. Who are these hacked people? Because if these are people who just have minor losses of their jobs, it's probably possible to compare these two harms here, and you don't have a clearly different answer from contractualism than utilitarianism. But contractualism becomes interesting when the hacked people are, for instance, people who have really vital file in those computers. Or if there are people who depend from this data. So maybe it's not so much the hacked people here, but all the people who depend on the data. In some cases, so think about the cases of a hack of a hospital. There can be people whose life depends on the data. And then contractualists will say, if you block and put the life of these people at serious risk, that's a lot of minus for this group. And no matter how small, how many people there are here with, say, 1++ or 2++++, this will always be more important. So basically it's like saying if the life of one person is at stake, it counts more than the losses of people who in the future may be hacked and will have to pay ransom. Yeah, there is no guarantee, but it's a matter of risk. And then you will determine the risk based on past behavior. So if you see that the behavior of that hacker group or of most hacker groups is such that when attacking a hospital, they were actually releasing the key, the encryption key, then you should seriously consider that. If the past shows you that money is basically wasted, then there is no case. Yes?
Well, we can see it from the other point of view, because when we do risk assessment, usually we consider the motivations. So by paying the ransom means you motivate people to hack more.
Yeah, it's a dilemma. It's a dilemma. But the point is, if so basically you are putting the actual risk of the people now with the merely possible risk of patients in the future, I still think that from a contractualist point of view, you could argue that the very actual risk, I mean, you have the patients out there, and there's some data in the computer that really it's vital for them, and if you don't get the data, some serious, like, health issue, unrecoverable health issue will happen. In such a situation, this risk is so much more concrete than it overrides the future risk which you may cause. But of course, if the harm is such that, for instance, can be recovered, if the patient can be compensated, if it's merely, I don't know, his cure needs to be prolonged by 2 weeks, but there is no lasting damage, then your argument may be considered, because you have the present patients with their level of risk and the future patients more or less at the same level. But in some other cases, you know, you will have people whose level of risk is so much higher, and we also kind of discount the future reasonably, because we don't know what the future would be like. Maybe some technology will make these attacks completely updated, so all this concern for the future, you must discount it somehow. Okay, I think we went through the different theories. Quite in a lot of detail. I found the discussion interesting personally. I also learned from it. I got a better grasp from the democracy and censorship arguments, so thank you for that. And I imagine this wasn't easy. This was really intense and kind of a crash course into lots of ideas. But I hope that with the MOOC and maybe further teaching, you will learn more and be curious about these issues. Thank you very much for your attention.
So just a reminder, sorry, E211 is the lab room in the next 5 minutes. If you are not able to find it, just wait for me and I will lead you there, okay? Yeah. Thanks.